Now you put it on the 3. Today is August the 14th, 2008. We are at the Amelia Museum of History on 233 South 3rd Street, Fernandina Beach, Florida, 32034. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Program in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing Charles Hinton Gaines, a Marine. Date of birth, January 28, 1929. He was born in Jacksonville, Florida. My name is Gerhard Tam, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Also, with assisting me is Don Hill, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin the interview. First, tell us a little bit about, briefly, what you did before you joined the Corps, and then just go chronologically and through the boot camp. Tell us how good the food was in boot camp, and what a great drill instructor you had, and et cetera. Okay. Go ahead.
All right. I was in high school here. I went to school here the entire time, and I played football and everything here at the high school, and I graduated in the 12th grade, and I took a summer job. I helped build a pier out on there as one of the jobs I had in the summer, and I decided to go into the Marine Corps. The war had just ended. That's World War II. And I wasn't old enough to get in that, but after I graduated from school, I decided I would be a Marine, and I joined, and they sent me to Parris Island. And I got off at Yemassee off the bus, and I was sitting there waiting on another bus to come take me to Parris Island. A couple of Marine sergeants come by and picked me up and took me there and dropped me off at headquarters. And I spent the first night in headquarters company sleeping on a hard bench with one pillow and a blanket. And the next day, the guy come up, very well-dressed Marine, and signed for me. I started walking down the sidewalk, and I looked, and I seen some people over there with shaved heads. And I asked him if those was prisoners. And he said, yes, they're prisoners. They're here on Parris Island for a while. And he said, you will be one of them tomorrow. And that's when I realized, I think I made a mistake, but I'm going to go through with it anyway. And he told me then, don't ever address him. Don't walk beside him. Don't talk to him unless he tells me to. So that was my first day in Parris Island, and there was many hard days after that. But I made it through. The food was very good. My uncle, who was a Marine on Guadalcanal, Peleliu and several islands over there, told me, be quiet and don't let them find out your name, and you'll make it. And that's the best advice I got. I never open my mouth. I don't want them to know my name. So I graduated in platoon 258, and I come home 30 days leave and went back to Parris Island, where we got a group and went down to Yemassee and got on the train and left for California. That's when we all was divided into what parts we're going to be.
Now, what date was that?
It was, I went in November, and it was about a 13-week course there for, you know, everything, and I was out probably in February.
November of
1948. 48. Yeah, and I graduated from high school in 47. Now, we went on this train. We stopped in Atlanta once, and we stopped in Albuquerque, and there was a another train beside us, and this train here was just coming in from Houston, Texas, where a bunch of movie stars had dedicated the Shamrock Hotel. And, of course, we discovered the movie stars, and they discovered us, and we got on around and had a good time for about 30 minutes. And we had a good time with these movie stars, and I remember Ward Bond and Dorothy L'Amour and a few more famous stars in my day. But we left Albuquerque and went over the mountains, and we stopped in a mountain pass up there, and it was full of snow. And this is the first time I ever seen any snow. And, of course, we had to jump off the train while it was stopped and throw a few snowballs. And we went on to Los Angeles, where a cattle car, you remember the old semi-trailer, they call it the cattle car? It was picked us up and took us down to Camp Pendleton. And then a couple of days later, we was taken down to the ocean front, Oceanside, California. And Camp Del Mar is the school for radio, telephone, Anglico, and Amtrak, you know, tanks and stuff. That, this is a training ground school. And, of course, I went to low-speed radio school and become a radio operator. And then after graduation, we went back up to Camp Pendleton, where we done, you know, maneuvers every day and things like that. It just things that Marines do. And I went out for the football team there. And, of course, I was a little too small, but I did have the privilege of trying to teach a man how to center the ball. That was my job. I was a center. And as member of the team, I got to go to the Rose Bowl, where the Camp Pendleton played Fleet City for the service championship. And we kind of tore them up pretty bad that day. But the only time I've ever seen the Rose Bowl. It's quite a place. And then a short time later, they sent me to San Diego, and I went into the MCRD there, the recruit depot, and they had a high-speed school where they teach you, you know, the higher part of radio. I think about 12 words a minute is low speed, and above that, about 20 words a minute is high speed.
Now you're talking about Morse code.
Morse code, yeah. Very little voice was used. It was all Morse code, and sometimes it was in plain English, and sometimes it was in code in five-letter sections. And, of course, we turned it over to the people that decoded it, and we never knew what the message said. But after I graduated from high speed, while I was there in school, was the time that the B-36 airplanes was coming in at San Diego Airport, and they come right over to school and would shake the entire building. It was so big. And we graduated and went back to Camp Pendleton, and at just about the time all this was taking place, the Korean War started, and we packed our gear, and a lot of the guys was consigned to, or TAD, I guess you'd call it, to different line outfits, and I was put in headquarters company. And one weekend on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, we went to Coronado Island and loaded ammunition on the USS Whitesides, which was a cargo ship. And
Now we're talking now 1950.
Yeah, 1950. And I didn't go back to Camp Pendleton after that because I brought my sea bag with me and ready to go. So we was put aboard the George Clymer, the USS George Clymer. And that was one of the two troop ships that took us to Korea, and we went through the Straits of Japan there, and right after we passed through there, the word come to test the weapons on these ships. And the radio room, which I was working, I was in there copying Fox. And I guess most people know, most Navy men know, that Fox is something that's broadcast 24 hours a day to the entire world. And if it pertains to you, you got a message. So I was right up under a gun mount. And when that thing went off, I was prepared to leave the ship immediately. But somebody caught me and told me what it was, but it scared me. And we went on into Pusan and docked. And we unloaded our equipment, the longshoremen did, and we got in it as it come off. Everything was marked, and we knew what was what. And I was one of the first vehicles because the captain was in the Jeep, and I was in the back seat of the Jeep as radio operator and in communication with the whole convoy leaving. And while I was waiting on them to open the gate, this soldier, Korean soldier, hollered at a girl, and she was walking down the street, and he hollered again, and she began to run, and he shot her down. And we kind of looked at each other, you know, like, welcome to Korea. This is our first night. And we had a convoy on out, headed kind of northwest at a little town, Maesan. And this is where we camped out there, and we was taken over at daylight from the 24th, I believe 24th Division, who had been forced back to there.
24th Infantry Division.
Yeah,
Army.
Okay, 24th Infantry. And anyway, I was parked on the road, and we had a big 6x truck. I got in this with the radio van. And that was when I become net control. They put me in there because I was high speed. Down below us was engineers, and up above us on the hill there was some other outfit. My generator trailer had trouble with the distributor, wouldn't stay tight, and it would turn and from vibration and get out of time on the engine and start backfiring. Well, when it started backfiring, the engineer started shooting at the people on the hill, and we was in the middle. And we had a little friendly fire fight that night, and I don't think anybody was killed, but we was a little nervous. And the next morning at daylight, the Army come through, and then we took off, the line outfit took off. And, of course, being the net control, I was quite busy taking all the messages that come in, how we was doing. And the first day, we gained 25 miles back. And this is the first encounter that the North Koreans had hit the Marines. And we drove them 25 miles back.
Now, what organization was that, the Marines?
1st Marine Division. And I was in headquarters company, and I was net control. So, like I say, I was quite busy receiving messages as wounded and killed and things like that constantly. We stayed there about a day and a half, and we got aboard a train and went back the other side of Pusan, I don't remember the name of the town, and took over and relieved a cavalry, a second, 1st or 2nd Cavalry, I don't remember. It's been a long time ago.
First
Cavalry. And we relieved them, and we was on this little train and narrow gauge railroad, and all these tanks on there, and the Marines were sitting on the sides. And when we got close, word came down to test your weapons, and we all spotted the same target. It was an old farmer out there in the rice paddy that was driving a goat ahead of him, and we all began to shoot at the goat. And none of us hit him. We all shot, I don't know how many shot. even a machine gun on the tank. But we never hit that goat. Now, that's pretty bad for Marines. You can't hit a goat. But we stayed over there a couple of days, and then we come back over here, and it was back and forth from Mason to over there. And we was there, I forget, about 4 weeks. And the name of the outfit was First Provisional Marine Brigade. That was what we was called. In the meantime, the division out of Camp Pendleton had loaded and packed up and come over, stopped at Japan one day, and then we got us back aboard ship. We turned everything over to the Army, and we went around and made the Incheon landing, the amphibious landing. And like I say, I was net control on the ship, but I could, off-duty hours, I could see everything, and I went ashore about the third rotation. I had to, you know, our gear was not priority, and it didn't go off first. So we went in to Incheon, and then as we made advances to Seoul, I remember the little town of Askom City, and we camped out in a schoolhouse for a few days, sleeping on the hard floor, but it was dry. And then we went to Kimpo Airport. I remember that, and that was the big airport for Seoul. And they had already captured that, and we moved in there. And then the Air Force and all began to bring supplies in, and the infantry boys went on, captured Seoul, and was going north and joined up with ROK, which is Royal Korean Army, and they went north. We turned around and went back to Incheon, got back aboard the ships, come around the tip of Korea and come up the east coast to Hungnam. This harbor was there, and we were ready to do an amphibious landing there, but they found it was so heavily mined that we could not enter that harbor with the ships, and the Navy had some wooden hull destroyer escorts, which minesweepers. Uh-huh. And they cleared the harbor enough that we could go ashore. And of course, once we pulled up to the docks, there was no longer a need for amphibious landing. And we pulled up to the docks, there was a big sign that said, "Welcome to the Bob Hope Show." He had already been there and gone. So we just unloaded and at the docks, and then the infantry companies went on ahead. We come along behind them, and I went up to a town, Coterie, which is quite a ways up in the foothills there, and this is where we set up. And I had been promoted to field promotion to sergeant, and I was acting as a net control while the line companies continued on up the mountains. And they got to the little town of Hagaruri, and I stayed there at Coterie, and we went out on liberty, kind of. We got permission from the captain, and of course I was a senior man, but there was three of us, and the Army MPs stopped us and wanted to know what we was doing there. "This is a combat zone." I said, "No, a combat zone's about 25 miles up the road." But we had a few words, and he wanted to place us under arrest, and he didn't know, but I had a .45 in my belt, and I told him, "Get back in the Jeep and leave us alone. We know what, you know, we'll get back." He thought we was deserters, but anyway, when I got back to camp, the captain wanted to see me. That MP was in the captain's tent, and the captain said, you can't spend one day without getting in trouble." And I said, "Well, I didn't know the man wanted to arrest us." He said he would have probably brought you back here. I said he wanted, you know, thought we was deserting. But anyway, I got my stripe taken away. I was back down to corporal again. And we stayed there until the division General Smith moved his headquarters into Hagaroo, which is, I think, 12 miles up further in the mountains. And the line companies went over Tectong Pass into the little town of Udamni. And this is the furthest penetration that we made. The army that was with us, they got to Hagaroo. They made the east side of the Chosin Reservoir, and we was on the west side. The furthest penetration was Udamni. And I set up in Hagaroo, and the general's tent was right across the street from me. And I had a message runner to run messages back and forth. And I acted as net control. And then all of a sudden, we got attacked from all directions. And the word come down that this was Chinese. They had been there all this time and let us in. They just faded back into the hills. And they was wearing white coats. And you couldn't see them in the snow. And then they come out and surrounded all three towns, Udamni, Hagaroo, and Coterie. And Coterie is where Chesty Puller's outfit was in reserve. But as it turned out, we didn't need him to come up there. We need to go back where he was at. But the British Marines, some of them was there, and we had some Turkey troops. And anyway, I think General Allman had give up on us because we were surrounded and they wasn't going to come get us. So General Smith said, we regroup the boys at Udamni, come back here and we will regroup and we'll walk out of here. We'll fight our way out. And Captain William Barber was assigned a group with Fox Company to hold that Tectong Pass open. That was the only way out. And he did for 3 nights and 2 days, even though he was wounded twice and was on a stretcher. His men carried him around, and he held that pass open until the line companies could come back and fight their way back to him. And then they joined up, and all of them come to Hagaroo, where I was at, and we joined up then as a group. We started to leave, and then some stray soldiers had walked in, and we realized that they had got hit so hard until there were just a few scattered men walking in. And we picked up what we could, and we went, sent patrols out looking for some and brought them in. I think we had 3 tanks recovered, but tanks was just a rolling pillbox with a machine gun because they was useless almost in that narrow road. And if one of them broke down, you just had to push it over the side. We ain't not gonna mess with it. And we started out there real slow, just walking. And the Marines on each side, and I was in the van part of the time, and then I was on the ground walking part of the time. And we had brought all our dead with us. We didn't leave anything that Chinese could use, no equipment. If we had to abandon a tank, we destroyed it. The gun and all equipment inside, it was no good for anything except scrap metal. And we come down to this other little town where Chesty Puller was, and we regrouped with him. And then the Chinese, there was one large bridge down by a dam. I don't recall the names of these, but they had destroyed that bridge so we couldn't get over it. It was a deep canyon. And we called the engineers, and they had a prefab bridge, and they brought it in by parachute, dropped in with it, put it together, and we come across that canyon anyway. We built our own bridge. And we come on down to Hung Nam Harbor and begin to get aboard ships. And down in the south part of Korea, I had contacted malaria. And then up there in that extreme cold, it was, you know, as high as 20, 30 below several nights. I turned into double pneumonia when I had these fevers every night, and then I had double pneumonia. But I was still able to do my job on the radio. And so they took me and put me on the hospital ship. And one of the first things they asked, would you like something to eat? Because it had been days since we had any decent food. We had sea rations, no way to heat them, and they had to eat them cold. The grapes in the fruit cocktail was, we'd play marbles with that. They was froze so hard. And, you know, it was quite an experience. But I said, yeah, I would like something to eat. And I went through the chow line. And I remember some corn and a cup of coffee. And I think of something like Salisbury steak. It was kind of a meatloaf thing. And this ship had the table arrangement where you stand at the table, you don't sit down. And I went to walk over there to put my tray down, and I thought at first the ship had turned over. And as it turned out, I had passed out and spilled everything, and I woke up a couple of days later after I got warm for the first time in a long time. I woke up, and a corpsman was there, and I said, I believe I spilled my corn, didn't I? He said, yeah, you did. But they was feeding me in the vein, and I got enough strength that every once in a while I could get up and have a little something to eat. And we went south down to Pusan. But first, let me say this, that when we brought our dead out, they was piled on like wood on trucks, laying on fenders, and we would tie them onto the cannon barrels and anything to get them out. And the Navy said we could not load those dead Marines on the ship. And the explanation was that they would defrost, and they couldn't handle that. So we dug a mass grave and made a marker and the dog tags and all. And all our dead was buried that hung them, you know, in a mass grave. We picked up thousands of civilians who was wanted to get out of North Korea, and this was their only opportunity to come out with us. And they put them aboard ships on the decks and down in the hole. And I seen one thing where the guys were looking, there was a ship was on fire, and he went down there, and the people had big fire, and they was trying to cook down in the hole of a ship. And he explained to them that you couldn't have an open fire on the ship, but they took them to Pusan, and eventually a lot of them come to the United States. I stayed in Pusan a few days around the hospital there until I got better, and they put me on a ship then coming back to the United States, and I rotated back on the second rotation out of there, and I landed in Treasure Island up in San Francisco Bay. And they held a parade for us, and we had, I don't know, they say about 50 convertibles that we was in and riding down the street, and the people welcomed us. Of course, all the girls around come running out and get a date with the Marine that night, you know, and we had a good parade and a good time. And then we was in Treasure Island. We got our orders to go to different places, and my assignment was 30 days at home and then report to Key West down at Boca Chica. There's a naval hospital there, and they wanted me to go there. And they treated me for malaria, and I don't know too much about it, but they claimed that they put a fluid in my veins that would coat the malaria germ to where it could not reproduce. And that's the reason I would have fever every night, is because it would reproduce every night. And they seemed to have got it under control by doing that. And I was stationed there at the Naval Station in Key West, and after they moved me out of the hospital, and where we was a guard unit there for the submarine base. Later on, I went to Villegas on maneuvers and then Camp Lejeune.
How did you get to Key West from the West Coast?
The story about the sergeant had bought a Buick convertible. He had quite a bit of back pay. I was getting ready to buy a train or bus ticket, and he says, come ride with me and help me drive. I'll drop you off in Jacksonville at your home. And he lived in Orlando. And I said, I know another man that's going that way, but he lives in Dallas, Texas. And he said, well, we'll pick him up. So I paid, I think, $200 for my part on the gas. And the guy from Dallas, his name was Null, and he paid $100. And that would give us traveling expense to come across. And we were doing fine. He drove from Treasure Island to Fresno, I think. And then from Fresno, I drove to Casa Grande, Arizona, which is where the road splits there. And we stopped in a restaurant to have breakfast. He got behind the wheel, and I got in the back seat and was going to go to sleep. We were following a semi on the old two-lane highway west of Tucson, and there's a two-lane highway and a ditch, irrigation ditch full of water on the right, on the south side. We was following a truck, and we met a truck coming toward us, and as soon as that truck passed, a big Buick sedan pulled out into our lane and hit us head-on. And we went into the air and landed upside down in that ditch full of water. And there we was, not completely submerged, but it was deep enough that half of the car was full of water. And we took a knife and cut that canvas top until we made a hole big enough to get out. And we come under the back of it and got there. The highway patrol come and checked on us. The people in the Buick was agricultural official from Mexico. They was up here visiting, seeing how we do things in farming, and it killed both of them. And we got our sea bags and everything out. They was wet. Highway patrol took us into Tucson, put us into a hotel. They took our clothes to the laundry, and they dry cleaned them and pressed them and got everything dry again. No charge. We got the keys to the city. And in the statement, the highway patrol says, you mean you guys just on that return trip from Korea just come in and then you live through that wreck? He said, somebody up there likes you. And I guess that's what, somebody was protecting us. We made it home and then lived through a wreck like that. And then I had to buy a bus ticket anyway into Dallas, and then we changed, and I rode a train from Dallas to Jacksonville, and that was the way I got home. And then, like I say, I had 30 days, and then I went to Key West down there. They wanted me to check in down there, and they cured the malaria. At least I don't have it anymore. And after we went to Villegas on maneuvers, little story there, I lived in the Bahamas when I was a small boy, about 12 years old, for a year. And I learned about the Florida lobster, which is langusta is the name of it. And I knew how to catch them and all about them. So I went out and caught some and was boiling them in my helmet. And officer would come by and he says, what are you doing? I explained to him I was boiling some lobster. He said, where'd you get them? I said, right out there. He says, can you get some more? I said, no, sir, I got too many duties. Well, if you didn't have any duties, you'd get all you want. Yes, sir, that's right. He said, well, consider yourself duty-free. We're going to have some lobster. And they put up a tent and some tables. the Navy sent in some butter and a pot to boil them in and all, and that was my duty to get lobster and feed the officers. And everybody would come in. And it was good duty. I enjoyed it. Got a good suntan. But then we went to Camp Lejeune. They took us veterans that had come back and held had a school to where we was teaching young radio people emergency procedures. The people over there was good at jamming the radio equipment. You know, sound like a buzzsaw or bagpipe playing while you was trying to transmit a Morse code. And they really interfered with us good, and we taught them different ways that we found to switch channels or when they would turn the noise off to listen to see if we were still there. We'd get in a word or two real fast, and then they'd start back again, and then they'd turn it off in a minute to find out if we were still there and get in another word. But we found ways to communicate, and we was teaching those ways to the younger people that just coming in that had never been overseas. And come my time for discharge, I put my clothes in my car and come home. I had a little Chevrolet automobile, and I
remember the date you got discharged.
Pardon me?
The date you got discharged.
Oh yeah, I remember that. Yeah, they told me the captain wanted to see me in his office, and I went down there, and he told me I was going home. Here's my discharge papers and all. So I went out to the parking lot and got my car and backed it up on the grass and raised the window in the barracks and throwed all my stuff out, went outside and throwed it in the trunk, and I was ready to go in about 5 minutes.
So, now, that was in 1951?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I don't remember the day, but I come home and I didn't get much use out of my radio training. I could have went into the Merchant Marines, and at first I was, I don't know, just pulling his leg. I said, if you make me a officer, I will do it. And they did. And I said, no, I changed my mind. But that's the only use I could find at the time to be a radio man. And so I didn't get much use out of my training back in civilian life. But one little thing that when I first went in there and got examined, they told me I couldn't drive military vehicles because I'm colorblind. I'm colorblind to the combination of red and green. I can't read green writing on a red background or vice versa. So after I went in business here with my dad, and he made me partner in the dairy. And when we sold the dairy, I went into the trucking business and was a truck driver for 20 years. For a man that couldn't drive, I'd done pretty good. So that was about my time, and go ahead if you.
Well, I think that's a pretty good story that you tell us.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else that you'd like to tell us about your Marine Corps?
Well, like they say, always a Marine. Once you was one, you're always a Marine. But I'm a vice commandant of the local Marine League here and all, but I always been proud of the fact that I was a Marine, and I've always been proud of the fact that we, in our Marine training, we had the ability to stand up to 120,000 Chinamen and walk out. You know, they didn't defeat us. So the first time the Chinese Army met the Marine Corps, they lost.
Spoken like a true Marine. Well, this concludes the interview, and we'll sign off. We'll thank you for sharing your recollections with us and the nation. This concludes the interview of Charles Hinton Gaines.
My pleasure.